All right, so on to the terrestrial environment. Okay, so what is one way that we can negatively impact the environment, the terrestrial environment around amphibians? Now we're talking about, you know, a concern for post-metamorphic survival. Okay, so talking about the adults and the juveniles. And what can we do to that landscape to negatively influence it? What are some of the land uses we talked about? What's that?
Creating hard edges,
exactly. Yeah, and hard edges could be anything that's not natural, really, you know, to that amphibian. And that can be a lot of different things. That could be a road, that could be an agricultural field, that could be the edge of a forest. So yeah, creating hard edges. That we're just beginning to develop research to understand what hard edges do or unfamiliar edges do to movement, how they can be barriers of movement. And Dr. Rothermel talked a little bit about some of the research that they just did, and I'll share with you in a little bit another study with respect to roads deflecting movement of salamanders. So kind of embedded in that question, one of those land uses and common land uses is agriculture, right? And so one thing that we can think about with respect to a conservation technique, right, and it's just intuitive, is to limit the amount of agriculture near the wetland. Now the question is how close? And this is a question, quite frankly, that we really can't answer. We're just building the knowledge base. And I'll share with you some of that knowledge base, and we really need more information, more studies to be conducted. But one recommendation is, and this is actually hot off the press, just published in the journal Wetlands last week, and by one of Ray Semlich's students, we always keep talking about Ray Semlich. Dr. Semlich over at University of Missouri has really been leading these types of studies for about the past 10 years. And these results are actually in one of your handouts here. Tracy Rittenhouse was his student, and she basically used kernel estimations of home ranges to look at activity movements based on research she collected, data she collected, as well as other people, to figure out where is most of the movement of, and I think she did just look at adults, not juveniles, but where is most of the movement concentrated for a variety of species, both salamanders as well as a number of anurans. And well, you can read that, but on the back side, she has a really nice graph that kind of illustrates it, and this is a kernel estimator that shows where the highest densities are, the greatest movement, the greatest amount of movements are with respect to proximity to the wetland. And 50% of the species are covered within, or have their movements within 100 meters of the wetland. But an interesting thing that you will notice is that to go up to 95%, which is maybe of interest, you have to go all the way up to 650 meters to include 95% of the species out there. Okay, and again, this is her species that she used, but she has Rannids, she has Bufos, she has Ambystoma salamanders, and she also has Newts. And oh, she has a Pseudacris in there as well. Okay, so pretty good number of genera represented. So, well, anyways, the conservation recommendations, what they recommend is, you know, at least 100 meter buffer. Now, I'll present some other information that one of Semlich's other students, Bodie, presented in 1998, which has those recommendations a lot wider. So if I ask you to, you know, provide some thoughts on, you know, how wide you would make a buffer, I would kind of expect you to reflect on this study here, but also what I'm going to present on, I think maybe the next slide, which is Semlich and Bode's results, which is a required reading. And also the recommendations that are provided by the Tennessee best management practices, okay? The forestry best management practices for Tennessee, and what should be the buffer width. And they particularly are focused on buffers around streams or streamside management zones. And we'll get to that in just a second. What their recommendation is versus some, suggestions from research out of Ray Semlich's lab. Now that's one thing, okay, a buffer, but let's at least, if we establish the buffer, which is important, okay, now the next thing is, what if you want to allow some type of activity? And farmers often hay around wetlands. They may have areas that they plant, etc. And a general recommendation, although there's very little research to my knowledge that backs this number, but that number is in this book, which I'll pass around, is for you to leave stubble that's greater than 30 centimeters in height, which is what, about a foot? Yeah. And again, the whole idea of this is, what are they trying to prevent? They're trying to prevent, you know, from getting too hot, right, on the ground and drying out. So reducing moisture and increasing temperature. So I am unaware of anybody that's done this from an experimental standpoint and compared relative temperature and humidity and survival rates of amphibians potentially in enclosures or something with different levels, different heights. And that really needs to be done. That also needs to be done with respect to exotics and native, for example, native grasses. I'm going to pass this around. Y'all can, the link to this, it's not available online, but you can buy it online. It's, I think, just like 10 bucks or something. And it's a pretty good overview of various recommendations for conserving amphibian populations in a lot of different types of systems. Now, a lot of the recommendations are based on, you know, just some gut feelings, because the research isn't there yet, but it's a first step, and that's specifically for our region, the Southeast. Now, obviously, other things to try to reduce the effects of agriculture, right, is to limit herbicides. And we talked about rodeo and the potential negative impact. Not rodeo. What was it? Roundup, thank you. Roundup and the potential negative impacts of Roundup on amphibian populations, both post-metamorphic and also larval, and that's work from Rick Relier, and y'all had a handout on that. Obviously, insecticides are probably, now there's been, Semlich has done quite a bit of work on insecticides. He started doing that stuff back in the 80s, and there can be some negative impacts. Often those impacts are not environmentally relevant. The amount of insecticides that ultimately wash down into the aquatic environment usually are not high enough to really probably cause negative impacts on developing larvae. In the terrestrial environment, though, think about it, it may not have direct impacts on the juveniles or the adults, or just maybe minor sublethal effects, but what is it doing? It's killing your food source. So again, limiting that type of activity if you can, and a lot of this is, you know, what can I do? I mean, this is happening across the landscape, you know. Well, if you're an on-game biologist and have an opportunity to interact with landowners, you can provide some of these suggestions. Also, if you're managing an area, wildlife refuge or state game area or wildlife management area, and you're interacting with sharecroppers, you can use this knowledge to try to conserve some amphibian habitat, okay, up in the upland areas, where a lot of these species are spending most of their time. All right, now, another obvious impact that we can have is forestry practices, and next year, if you're around, see what I'm lecturing on this, because I will have just a lecture on how does forestry influence amphibian populations, and that was planned this year, but unfortunately I didn't get to it. But in general, I'll share this with you, although the verdict is still out, there's a lot of critics on both sides suggesting that partial cuts are more beneficial than clear cuts. And there are some folks that suggest that clear cuts do not impact amphibians. Anyways, that's an interesting, and for some species that may be true, but for the majority of them, as you all know, that's probably going to negatively impact them. And work out of University of Maine, Dr. Malcolm Hunter, has shown unequivocally that it severely negatively impacts salamander populations. Now, the anurans, it's more up. I guess the verdict is still out a little bit, and there are certainly going to be negative impacts on species that, well, on some species, the toads seem to be less impacted. All right, now, as you all recall, Ray Semlich and Malcolm Hunter and Betsy Rothermull and Whit Gibbons down at Savannah River Ecology Lab, all those guys, and James Gibbs, who's up at State University of New York, Syracuse, are all working on this comprehensive project to really answer some of these questions. And so they have this really neat design. It's funded by NSF, and they're doing various types of cuts around a wetland and looking how that may impact movement as well as survival. They have enclosures in here, as you may recall, looking at survival of post-metamorphic individuals. Okay, so that'll be really neat. I probably expect to see some of those results published. Some of that stuff's already being published, but especially in the next 2 to 3 years. Nothing like this has ever been attempted at all. All right, now, it has been suggested that shelterwood cuts are a partial removal technique that seems to have less impacts on amphibians. So as you're working with your forester potentially on a wildlife area, this is one type of silvicultural technique that you could try to work with them, although they often don't like to do this in a lot of cases because it costs more. But there are forestry benefits to this as well, which includes enhancing regeneration of desirable species within areas that are partially cut. So shelterwood cut is a forestry term which for those that haven't had a wildlife forestry background may be unfamiliar with. But in general, what you're doing is you're going in and you're reducing the density of trees. And specifically, one thing that foresters look at is they do something called, they calculate basal area, which is the amount of square feet of wood per acre. And there's actually a device that you can estimate that with called a basal area factor prism to determine the basal area of an area. And so the recommendation is for shelterwood is to cut your mature trees so they drop down to a basal area of around 50 square feet per acre. Or another guideline that is used is basically about 50% of the basal area. Whatever you start with, go to about 50% of it. And those mature trees that you leave should be large trees, healthy trees, mature trees that will provide shade, which is important, right? Maintain some of that microhabitat, as well as from the forestry perspective, it also provides seed. And the ones you generally want to leave are ones that are desirable for forestry, which probably are just as good for amphibians. They need something just over them. And they're also seed-producing trees and help with regeneration. Now, what you then do with the shelter woodcut is then you go back in there at some duration, anywhere between 5 and 10 years. And for if you're concerned with amphibians and managing and conserving them, I would go to longer duration, 10 years, if you can. Then you go in and you remove those mature trees. Now, the problem with going in 10 years to 15 years is what does an area that's cut look like 10 to 15 years? It's pretty darn thick, yeah. And so that that becomes more of a challenge with respect to getting in your forestry equipment and stuff like that. So, you know, we always want to, you know, and when we get to the buffers, you know, we love the ideal scenario, but we have to work within the realism of what we can do, even if we're conservationists and we're working with, you know, foresters and stuff like that who, you know, like, you know, their job is to grow trees and cut them down and make money, but it's they're also being trained to be cognizant of wildlife habitat, and wildlife also bring dollars to areas for viewing purposes as well as hunting opportunities. Not necessarily hunting salamanders, but anyways. All right. Any questions with that? Flashback from FWF 410. Yeah. All right. Now, after cutting, if you can convince your guys to leave the slash, the tops, the crowns of the trees, which often they don't like, a lot of times they do because it looks ugly, but it's a good thing. Okay, and this actually is generally less work to leave the crowns of the trees, and they just take the trunk and off they go. So that's a good thing, provides some microhabitat, and it provides habitat for other things like rabbits and stuff like that. And not to remove the decomposing logs or the stumps or the dead trees that are around. Those are all good microhabitat components for amphibians and for other wildlife. The other thing is to minimize soil disturbance. Okay, so as you can imagine, you have things like various types of heavy equipment that's going in and out carrying these logs after they're cut down, and then they're loaded onto these huge trucks that you've seen drive down the road, etc. And all of these pieces of equipment, they go to an area, they have trails that they pull the trees to, which are called skidder trails. And they have an area, a kind of a loading dock area, where then they load those onto the truck. And so if you have an opportunity to interact with a forester, if you can attempt to minimize that soil disturbance and that destruction, that's probably a good thing. Again, with heavy equipment going over and over ground, it increases compaction, which it's reasonable to assume it's going to decrease their ability, amphibians' ability to burrow into those areas. So you want to limit as much disturbance as you can. Now, it is recommended, actually in that book, that you do it on drier sites. In other words, get out, you know, if you can establish your skidder trails up out of the wetland area, higher the better, away from a water area. Use low pressure tires and minimize your skid trails. Now, that you know, low pressure tires are just something either the guys you're working with have them or they don't. All right. Now, what else can we do within the terrestrial environment? Well, you know, here we're dealing with all these things that really are talking about, again, that temperature, you know, that temperature and that moisture component, reducing the probability of any individual to ultimately desiccate. So keep their skin moist. And some of these things also work into promoting abundant insects or food resource. Another thing you can do to promote abundant insects from a wildlife management perspective is what we do. Wildlife management. Create lots of insects. Spray insecticide? No. What do we do? that everybody likes to do? Burn, right? You can burn. And burning promotes lush vegetation and releases nutrients, and in general, in most systems, it results immediately in an increase in insect populations. So one thing that they go into quite a bit in that book is they talk about to try to restore the natural fire regime, the historic fire regime, if you can, if it's allowed, acceptable by public, and if you know what that historic regime is, and if not, then to follow some type of fire rotation that is known to positively influence insect populations. So that differs depending on the system, and I guess we won't get into those details. But I don't know, you guys that are back there, wildlifers, what would you say for a grassland area, how often would you burn it?
3 years.
Every 3 years? Okay. Don't burn it all at once, burn it in quarters, and then have it on a rotation about every 3 years if you have grassland surrounding your wetland. And forestry, the foresters, how often they burn forests? Maybe once, not very often, just depends. Every 3 to 4 years as well. Yeah. So those are things that you can do to every 3 to 4 years sounds like a good rotation. Now, the other thing, and this hasn't even been investigated at all, and I would, I mean, this is a master's project just waiting to be looked at, is to, oh, I mentioned spring burns, primarily because spring burns, to get it done early before amphibians are coming out, and they really rely on that terrestrial environment for lush vegetation and insect population. So if you do it early in the spring, then by basically when they're really using that upland area, by mid-spring, it's getting lush, and by summer you've got a good lush stand of vegetation and hopefully a pretty good developing vertebrate population. Spring burns often tend to be pretty effective too at providing desirable plant communities. And if you do have a grassland community that you want to establish that may have been there historically, or that you just would like to have a native warm season grass area around a wetland, is burning helps establish that. And also periodic soil disturbance like some disking. Now, native warm season grasses, my hypothesis, although we don't know this, and this is where a study could come in, is that I think that they would probably be beneficial, more beneficial than, for example, Bermuda grass or something like that that is out there that grows very, very dense. Native warm season grasses grow in bunches, and they're really tall, and they have very high insect abundance, and they also don't grow in mats on the ground, which actually, if you can think about, think about an amphibian hopping along or crawling along, something that is like a really like a spider web of grasses could be a challenge moving through. It also, may increase your chance of being predated. But these things also have greater structure, native warm season grasses, which also, may create desirable abiotic conditions on the ground. But it would be interesting to look at post-metamorphic survival of amphibians in basically grasslands dominated by exotics and grasslands dominated by native species, and make some inferences with respect to the changes in the abiotic conditions and the food resources. Never been done. There you go, Casey. Master's project for you. Yeah. All right. Now, the other thing, and this is true for, we always talk about corridors and stuff with wildlife, and corridors are a big debate, but for amphibians, if you don't have a corridor, there is a very high chance that you're going to die. trying to go across a foreign landscape. Now, like this one here, okay? Now, if this was a contiguous block of forest and you had a wetland over here, well, then that's all fine. You go up in the upland, it's nice and contiguous. But if this is something foreign, like it is here, which looks like it's agriculture, and you're running into that, your chance of survival probably is pretty darn low. You're either going to dry out and die, or you're going to get eaten by something, or you're going to starve to death because there's no food out there. So maintaining corridors is an important aspect. And you can think about corridors from with respect to here's your breeding pond to the upland area, which would just really mean is really kind of you hope to maintain the corridor between that and the quote-unquote terrestrial environment where the juveniles are surviving and living throughout the year as well as the adults through just a buffer, having one big block, maybe like you have here, okay? A block around the wetland. So these are areas of limited disturbance. And then, so that's aquatic to terrestrial sites. And then you need to think about corridors between different wetlands to try to maintain that historic movement. So spatially disjunct wetlands. Well, the obvious locations to have corridors and to maintain are riparian corridors. Those are always been natural conduits of movement, okay? And they're moist. And often there are some restrictions from an environmental standpoint with respect to how close you can get to a riparian corridor with disturbance. So really kind of maintaining that riparian corridor is an important thing in linking populations from wetland to wetland. And we'll talk about the widths of that corridor and what would be ideal on the next slide. Okay, so any questions? Make sense? Good stuff? All right. Okay. All right, so let's talk about this. You know, how wide should these corridors be? You know, or how wide should these buffers be? You know, what should we try to maintain? Okay, so Semlich and Bode in 2003 published a paper in Conservation Biology which summarized a bunch of information from a bunch of different species with respect to their average distance, migration distance from the aquatic breeding sites, and that's this handout here, and I just copied, the whole paper's on the website, but I copied Appendix 1, which shows you all the species that they investigated, which are a bunch of frogs and a bunch of salamanders, and including plethodontid salamanders. And that's what Tracy Rentenhouse, what she didn't include. She just included ambystomids. So they have all various types of genera. Okay, that are included, and they talk about basically how wide should these things be for amphibians and for reptiles, but they really separate them and talk about them separately. So these are their amphibian recommendations. So wetland buffers. All right. So if you have some type of depressional wetland or a small little reservoir, farm pond, or something like that, this is what they recommend for the distances. Okay. So what they found out is that on average species are moving somewhere on average across anurans and salamanders anywhere between 160 meters and 300 meters from the wetland. That's on average. Okay, there weren't any, they didn't do the whole probability density function thing, you know, that Rittenhouse did. They just said on average based on what's been published. So 160 to 290 meters. Now, if you break these things apart, pretty much put all the anurans in here and throw in the newts, which we've talked about before, moving a lot, having a really good orienteering capability. And then we have two families of salamanders, the ambystomids and the plethodontids. How far do they move from the aquatic environment? Okay. And again, you have species that move a lot, like the anurans tend to move farther away from the wetlands and the newts. And the ambistomids moderately, okay, you know, move around 100 meters from the wetland. And plethodontids, like the ones that we were dealing with this past weekend, are usually very, very close to a water source, okay? And again, they don't have lungs. So their ability to disperse, first of all, is more limited than other salamanders because they don't have lungs. And secondly, they really have to be especially concerned, although they don't think that way, with their skin drying out. But it's certainly probably a reason why you find them in closer association to water. Okay, and that's pretty much what we were finding, is that everything was really, really close to water or seeps or moist areas. And if we'd have ran a transect up into the upland, we would have seen that density drop. And that's what Semlich and Bodie kind of demonstrated just on a lot of different studies that people have done. So, but if you average all these things that they looked at least the groups, the species they looked at, on average 160, 290 meters. All right. Now, what they did with that range, with this this recommendation for buffer widths, is they broke it into three areas, zones 1 through 3. The first zone is considered the zone in which we're concerned in maintaining the quality of the aquatic environment. And that is, at a minimum, needs to be 30 meters. 30 meters for core 1, okay, the aquatic environment. And others have suggested that that 30-meter buffer does have relevance with respect to acting as an effective filter on insecticides and herbicides, okay, and sediment going in. So they recommend anywhere for that internal buffer to be, that first buffer to be 30 to 60 meters. Then they have a second zone, which they call the core, which is on average that distance of terrestrial habitat that is used by most species, well, species that they investigated out there, okay? And that goes out to the 290 meters here that they recommended, okay? So they say anywhere that this second core should go anywhere between, 140 to 290 meters about, okay? So 300 meters. So 30 for aquatic quality of the aquatic environment. Really, we should go out to 300 meters for the terrestrial environment, okay? Then they recommend, actually, that you have a 50-meter buffer on top of that. So you should go out to about 340 meters or 350 meters. So 340 meters. It's what they recommend. Okay? Now, if you combine that with Rittenhouse's results, 340 meters will probably take care of about a good 80% of the species. And how often, you know, and incorporate about 75% or so of the species, and how their average distance that they usually migrate to these terrestrial sites. If all of a sudden you have, and you need to think about this, this is going back to the results that we had from Texas, if all of a sudden you have, okay, let's put this out to 300 meters, and then you have a cotton field around here, what happens? They come out here, and boom, they hit it, and it reflects them back in. So you start to get an appreciation for at least one of the hypotheses from our results, which is, you know, one of the reasons why we may have higher densities in some wetlands, agricultural wetlands, and we found that, and some other folks found that, is because they're being constricted to this area, that these hard edges are reflecting their movements, okay? Now, we, in our systems, you know, we feel that there's some other things that were going on that were related to hydroperiod as well. Okay, now, what else? If we think about riparian buffers and also think about corridor recommendations between wetlands, Okay, depressional wetlands. This is the same thing that we're talking about. They still recommend the same distance. It's just that you're coming out from a linearly instead of in a circle. Okay, so they recommend the same distance. Now, if you're in forestry or if you take a forestry class and you learn about civiculture, you learn about the best management practices for forestry. And this is what you should follow to basically ensure that your forestry practices are quote-unquote environmentally friendly. Tennessee has their own guide, and most states have their own guide. Their recommendation for a buffer is 15 meters. And actually, only 10 meters of that needs to be trees. Okay? And they are primarily concerned here, and this is actually the recommendation from TDEC. And TDEC claims that basically in 15 meters, any contaminants, etc., will filter out. Some ecological studies that have suggested that 30-meter distance. Okay, but indeed, with respect to things running off, probably within 15 meters or below what are considered of a concern to EPA and TDEC. So they recommend a 15-meter buffer, and so that's what folks do. Now, this is about a 15-meter buffer up here. That's a nice streamside, quote-unquote, by the regs, a streamside management zone, okay? 15 meters on each side. And, you can see that's a pretty steep slope, so it may be a little bit wider than 15 meters. They're supposed to go out a quarter or three quarters of a meter for every 1% increase in gradient. So this is on flat ground. And then as you go up, because, you know, you have an increase in water velocity and things like that coming off, you know, slopes that are off of slopes compared to flat ground, they recommend that you increase the buffer width. So anyways, that's their recommendations. But the bottom line is that these are extremely inadequate to cover the requirements, the terrestrial habitat requirements of nearly all your amphibian species, okay? There are only a few that will stay with, that will use only within 10 meters or 15 meters of a wetland. Most all of them are going farther than that, even the plethodontids. There'll be, of course, there's times of the year when they're all right at the aquatic breeding areas, there's variation among individuals, but even the plethodontids are moving farther, moving out, you know, 15 meters. We saw that. We were much farther than 15 meters from the streams. So that's something to think about. And if you have the opportunity to work with foresters to see if you can, the wider the better. I don't know if you'll get very many landowners or agencies that will be interested in, if they're interested in harvesting their trees, interested in basically leaving a 300 meter, that's a quarter mile. 300 meters is a quarter mile, pretty much, you know. That's a good one. That's a lot. Yeah. I mean, so that's like three football fields. And what, a football field's a hectare or something like that? I don't know either, something like that. But whatever. All right, but because what it comes down to is dollars. I mean, you're gonna, you know, you're limiting your profits when you, there are no environmental regulations about doing the 300 meter buffer. So, what I would suggest is at least a 30 meter buffer. If you can get 30 meters, good. 100 meters would be ideal. Going back to Rittenhouse's recommendations. At least that covers about 50% of the species based on her density estimates, her simulations. So 100 meters would be awesome. If you can't get that, then at least get 30. So might be able to get 100 depending on who you're dealing with. One other thing too that they recommend, which was, I think, published this originally. I think it was Malcolm Hunter or somebody else, talked about, well, at least preserve no activity at all within this core, this aquatic buffer. But in the core habitat, you can allow some light activity. So maybe come in here if it's forestry, for example, and allow them to reduce down to, well, not to 20, only 25% of the basal area, of the original basal area. So, you know, we were talking about the shelter wood cuts, you go down to 50% of what was there, only go down to, only take out 25%, or go down to 75% of what was there. So you could have some, maybe some light activity in there, some selective cutting, and, you know, it's all about compromise. So whatever you can do to, you know, increase that buffer width. All right?
Has anyone pushed
them to
change those guidelines?
No, nobody has. And, no. Again, they're most concerned with water quality. And maybe with time we can get TDEC and EPA to be concerned with, and again, it's probably good enough for water quality, but it's not going to be good enough for the terrestrial habitat. But maybe we can begin to have some of these environmental, these conservation recommendations incorporated into legislation. Yeah. Well, and that's another good point. Excellent point, Casey, is that these are recommendations. You can actually have disturbance right up to the, well, to the stream. As now, well, see, TDEC, we have the law for TDEC is you cannot impair the water quality. Okay? And these are recommendations that they have. If you actually increase sedimentation into a watershed, you're impairing water quality, and that is a violation of one of their laws. In fact, that's how they protect wetlands in our state, is using the legislative act. But anyways, you need to get what's called an aquatic resource alteration permit. Thank you very much. Too many things in my brain to try to retrieve. Well, they can. But if they're in violation, if you're in violation of needing a ARRAP, aquatic resource alteration permit, you can be fined daily, and those fines can be substantial. So the thing is enforcement too. You know, I mean, it's hard. TDEC doesn't have folks out. It's almost observation of a biologist out there reporting it to TDEC. But yeah. Most of their enforcement comes with wetlands directly. And so if you're in there and you are bulldozing in a wetland area, which a lot of riparian areas are, you need a permit to do that. And so that's the first thing, and that wetland can actually be farther away than 15 meters. And so that's often your saving grace, is that things fall, can be designated as a wetland. But once it gets into the terrestrial environment, the recommendations, they are 15 meters. And they throw that out there as, well, that's probably the distance required to maintain where you're not negatively influencing water quality. Okay. Any questions? All right. So, what about small wetlands? During the 90s, we'll talk about some recent changes in federal wetland legislation, but during the 90s, there was a push to basically say, well, let's make the federal regulations on protecting wetlands less stringent. And in particular, small isolated wetlands are probably not as important as big wetlands. So the federal regulations prior to this century basically covered any type of isolated wetland, okay? And there's a history behind wetland regulation, which we'll just touch on just very briefly, but unfortunately won't be able to get into. If you're interested, take that ecology class that I was telling you all about. We'll get into it in this fall. So first of all, just to kind of demonstrate the importance of wetlands, Gibbs, who's again at SUNY Syracuse, when he was at Maine, he looked at, there was legislation suggesting that pretty much anything less than 4 hectares, we changed the law, so anything less than 4 hectares, you can destroy the wetland, okay? They're probably, you know, not that important. So Gibbs really looked at, what does that do? So he looked at a particular landscape within Maine, and he found out that if you destroyed everything, all the wetlands less than 4 hectares for his area, that it pretty much reduced it by about the total wetland area by just 20%. So that doesn't sound too bad. Still 80% of wetlands there, right? But he also measured what this did to interwetland distance. And Gibbs is a kind of a GIS modeling guy. And he demonstrated that basically by removing those wetlands, you increased interwetland distance by 3/4. So yeah, you're only reducing about 20% or 1/5 of the area of the wetlands, but look at the distance. And when we're talking about amphibians, these are, you know, not very vagile organisms. They don't have a great ability to move. And so what is the consequence? And he basically showed that on average, he was dealing with a very dense wetland environment. Interwetland distance went from 0.6 kilometers up to a kilometer. And as you recall, that kilometer distance is that distance that most amphibians, it's around their maximum dispersal capability. So you're starting to get towards that. And certainly in other parts of the country, you know, we don't have that high of wetland density. So the impacts of removing small wetlands could even be greater. This is an illustration. Here's just an aerial photo, and here are some big wetlands, you know, etc. And what we're really talking about doing by reducing all the wetlands less than 4 hectares is you remove all these small little wetlands in here, okay? Which again can act at these wetlands, which I'll talk about in a second, can be very important. Small wetlands can be source wetlands. They aren't always sink wetlands. That's another misnomer, is that, oh, they're just not important. A lot of these big wetlands are sink wetlands because they've got fish in them or something. And the other thing it does is then when you start talking about this interpond movement, it increases the distance and decreases their probability of successfully completing dispersal. Well, Semlich and Bode in 98, looked at wetlands on the Savannah River site in South Carolina, and they looked at, if you reduced everything, they got a lot of heat when they suggested this, and so this never came to fruition. So what they did is the feds said, well, what about less than 1.2 hectares, okay? What about wetlands just less than 1.2 hectares? Let's go ahead and just destroy those. They can't be that important. So on the Savannah River site, Semlich and Bode demonstrated for their area, here are basically your 1 to 2 hectare wetlands. You can see this is abundance of wetlands, the number of wetlands they have on this site. And the majority of them are basically less than 2 hectares. So what is this? What is the impact? And if you have your handouts or make a note here, this should say 1.2 hectares. The first one should say 1.2 hectares. I think it says 4 hectares. Okay? That needs to be changed. The first bullet is 1.2 hectares, not 4 hectares. So they looked at what happens if they move, if they remove all the wetlands that are less than 1.2 hectares. What happens? It increased interwetland distance by around 200 meters, and that represented an increase in interwetland distance by 43% on average. Okay. Then they looked at the 4 hectare. The 4 hectare criteria, everything less than 4 hectares, well, hell, that's the majority of their wetlands on the Savannah River site, and it increased interwetland distance by 640 meters, and which represented 136% increase in interwetland distance. And again, that's a concern. One thing we want to do is to maintain the possibility of interwetland movement. And that is certainly facilitated by wetlands being close to each other. Now, so ultimately this works at decrease the probability of dispersal, as we've talked about. Now, the other thing, the population consequence of not being able to interact acts both, as we've talked about before, from a genetic standpoint, genetic diversity and intermixing of different individuals from different populations, blah, blah, blah. But also the population thing, which we've talked about, okay? And that's an important thing. I want you to be able to remember that. I want you to remember that. What, you know, by impacting this movement, what can it do? It can affect genetic consequences as well as demographic. And ultimately, demographic, what it does is it reduces the chance of a rescue effect. And what is a rescue effect? And we've talked about that. That's when a population is declining because potentially it's a sink wetland. You know, in other words, survival is, mortality is greater than survival and in some capacity, and in the population is declining. So you need individuals from source populations coming into that population, into that system, to prevent it from going to extinction, and hence the name rescue effect. So one thing that Semlich also reported, I think he reported in this paper, is that small wetlands can be sources. They're not sinks. A lot of them aren't sinks. And that they are important. And they're also very speciose. They can have as many species as a larger wetland. And so he used an example, what is called the Rainbow Bay wetland, which is only a half hectare site on the Savannah River area, and they've been monitoring populations here for 16 years. And on average, that little wetland is producing close to 14,000 metamorphs per year. 14,000 metamorphs per year. That's a lot of individuals going into the environment, acting as a source for other populations. And also getting into all the energetic stuff and the energy flow stuff and productivity stuff that Roberto was talking about in his systems apply here as well. In fact, they're not in a tropical system. You don't have that high of production. They've also, in the 16 years, documented 27 amphibian species. I mean, that's more than our entire damn state. Oh, excuse me. More than the Anurans in our state, okay? 27 amphibian species. So again, the whole point here is that small wetlands are important because they can be speciose, they can be sources, and also they're important with respect to maintaining, quote-unquote, what the landscape ecologists call connectivity between different spatially disjunct populations. Now, I said all this stuff because they're important papers that relate to small wetlands, and I'll tell you it doesn't matter because none of them are freaking protected anymore. Thanks to recent Supreme Court decisions. All right. So, actually, late 90s, there was one rule called the Tulloch Rule, which prevented the dredging of wetlands, the digging out of wetlands. That was overturned, and now you can dredge wetlands. All right? That's fine. You can do it. And secondly, in 2002, 2003, there was what the Supreme Court made a decision on was called the Swank decision. It's an acronym. And isolated wetlands are no longer protected regardless of their size. All right, you can do whatever you want with them. You can fill the damn things in, you can dredge them, you can do anything. The only wetlands that are protected are those that are directly connected to a watershed. To a watershed that runs into a waterway. So the wetlands within Tennessee, because we have all these riparian, in other words, riparian wetlands, that's it. Okay? And the way that the current regs are is it does protect the wetlands around the Tennessee River and all major and minor tributaries and those associated with them. But currently, that is being fought as well in the Supreme Court. And it was a split decision pretty much last year, and it's gone back to the lower courts for additional review. And basically, the United States Supreme Court said, we're not quite sure. They split it 5-4 for protection of the wetlands. And they said, we're really not going to rule on this. We're going to send it back to the lower courts. And what this current case is suggesting is that the federal law does not protect wetlands high in the associated with tributaries that are high in the watershed. Only low in the watershed, and only those that are associated directly with a concern for for navigation that facilitates interstate commerce. And that sounds just very bizarre. You're like, what the hell are you talking about? Interstate commerce and wetlands, this doesn't make any sense. And it goes way back to the way that wetlands were protected initially in the 70s, which is with the Clean Water Act, 1972, and ultimately Wetlands Act in 1975, and then in 1977, defined in the Clean Water Act, Section 404. And it all comes back to that Clean Water Act, which protects our navigable waterways so that from filling, prevents navigable waterways from filling so that interstate commerce is maintained. So you can't fill in the Tennessee River, all right? Or any of the other major tributaries where barge traffic can go. Or maybe it has to be interstate commerce. So not even within your state does that really matter, okay? And wetlands got thrown in underneath of that legislation, okay? And for better or for worse, these decisions now, the decision that was made is that isolated wetlands do not fit into that definition. Okay? All the prairie potholes that exist, all the Playa Lake wetlands that I showed you, those thousands of wetlands, isolated wetlands that we have some in Tennessee and definitely down the East Coast and South Carolina in different areas, the Carolina Bay wetlands, which are small depressional wetlands. All of those, no, they're not protected. Yeah? No. It has directly connected to a tributary that ultimately flows to a major waterway. No, they don't. They're not protected under federal law, these isolated wetlands. Now, about half of our states have state wetland laws, and thank goodness our state does. So you cannot go in and dredge or fill a wetland in our state. You have to have approval first from TDEC, all right? And then TDEC will determine whether or not it also requires approval from the feds. And the feds that basically regulate wetlands is the Corps of Engineers, which goes back to this whole interstate commerce thing with waterways. Anyways, so so in our state, you do need a permit. And it's the aquatic, what was it again? ARAP. Aquatic Resource Alteration Permit, ARAP. That's what everybody says is ARAP. Okay, so you need one of those permits. What else? And in the case where you're destroying wetlands, yes, you have to mitigate where you're destroying, either if it's federally protected or if it's state protected. Okay. I think we'll see the higher tributary wetlands probably removed from federal protection before too long. All right, so last thing, what are the influences of roads? What could be some influences? Well, we've already talked about some of those things, and here are a bunch of papers here that, this is just a summary of what's in all these papers, okay? Obviously, number one, direct mortality. You know, we've been talking about deflection and that, which we'll illustrate here again, but just direct mortality. And I'm sure you all have been out there on a rainy night and seen toads and, you know, frogs and salamanders, you know, going across the street. And there's definitely mortality associated with that movement. Now, one of the studies that really kind of looked at this pretty intensively had estimated mortality rates in the wetland, and then also mortality rates associated with the road. And so kind of had natural mortality rates and had road mortality rates and looked at how they contributed to the population mortality rates. And did it with a lot of different wetlands. So it ranged from increasing mortality from 2% up to 20%. And this mortality rate was directly correlated with the proximity to a road. So this one, the 2% was farther away from the road. And the other thing is that for some species, but not for all, the mortality rate was directly connected with traffic intensity, meaning not distance to the road, but actually the number of cars going down the road per hour. So actually all part of the, I just said this a second ago, but part of this study was they showed the best predictor of mortality rates on roads was the distance to the wetland, to the breeding site. Okay, so the closer you were, the greater your mortality rate was. Yeah.
Is that because some of them will freeze and stop moving when the car comes? Or, I mean, it seems like if you're in the road, you're going to get hit by the car. Or some of them just keep hopping and get off the road?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they do. They keep hopping, but it's kind of like that old game back in the 80s, Frogger. I don't know it's like one of the first video games you could ever play. And it's basically you have cars going by and your chance you just get hit, you know.
Why is it different for some species?
Oh, because, now let's think about it. Toads, for example, as you increase the number of cars, they have a greater mortality rate. All right, let's think about how a toad moves. They hop and they hop and they hop. Think about a ranid, which jumps. I mean, it leaps. It's clear. It has to make fewer jumps to get across that road than the toad, which just keeps hopping, you know, at a slower rate. Salamanders, but if you've ever seen a salamander, they still move faster than a toad. I mean, they usually are only moving when it's raining. And you'll see them, they look real slimy. It almost looks like a small little snake. If it's raining, you see like, so all that looks like a small snake. Well, it's a salamander crossing the road. Stop and take a look at it. Try to miss it first, though. So for toads, they showed that their mortality rate definitely was related to number of cars. The other thing that they showed, though, is that you can have negative impacts on a population just with a low intensity of cars passed. You know, I mean, 5 cars per hour resulted in a negative impact. Now, that's, you wouldn't think, you know, 5, I don't know how many cars have gone past us since we've been in here, but definitely more than five in an hour. So, I mean, that's not very many cars. All right, so even low intensity can have an impact as well. Now, what else can roads do? Obviously, just direct habitat destruction, where you have a road going through a wetland, which, you know, TDOT does all the time and all the other Department of Transportations do out there, is it's easier just to keep the road going straight than to go around a wetland. It costs less. So TDOT actually is, Matt was asking about wetland banking, which is one way that you are charged for destroying wetlands. And TDOT is, maybe eight approved organizations or agencies out there that can actually have wetlands that they can use for banking. And they sell these wetlands to folks that destroy wetlands, and they mitigate the losses anyways. That's all wetland mitigation stuff. But TDOT has their own bank because they just buy up wetlands because they know they're going to destroy wetlands. And they use some of the wetlands in their own bank, and then they also sell those wetlands to folks that destroy wetlands to compensate for those losses. So they, you know, Department of Transportations across the country are part of wetland destruction. And of course, that's habitat. Now, more of a subtle thing though, and this was just published in 2006. Of course, Semlich was one of the authors. And what he demonstrated is even with forest roads, okay, forest roads have a negative impact on the suitability of the terrestrial habitat. And he showed that salamander populations significantly declined in the Appalachians, significantly declined once you got within 35 meters of either side of a forest road. Probably because it's changing that microhabitat characteristic, drying out. It's a little bit drier and very dry right on the road. So he called it a road effect zone of 35 meters. And in the area where he was doing this in the Appalachians, it was on in a national park. I don't know if it was in the Smokies or where, but in a national park. And so then he calculated the road effect and how much that reduced the overall terrestrial habitat for salamanders. And I don't know if I have that number here. It reduced the habitat by 1/3 in the park just by the road, all these damn roads going through it. And these are all various forest roads. And he found out it didn't matter whether they abandoned the forest road or if they maintained it. It still had negative impacts. Okay? So this is another reason why to minimize the number of roads you have, the number of skitter trails, and all that stuff. Because it still can have negative impacts. Now, what I would suggest is that, you know, the roads that you need to maintain, maintain. The roads that you don't need anymore, I would suggest to try to replant, and so that you establish that forest structure. There's still going to be some issues with soil compaction, but the bottom line to restore that system, at least partially, for salamander populations, you need that intact canopy. Okay? And this is the one that we've talked about several times, habitat fragmentation. So, this is one of the first studies, though, that actually has demonstrated this reflective movement. You know, Betsy did it, you know, on the edge of forests and stuff, but Marsh et al. 2004 published this and showed that they actually took salamanders and displaced them across the road and looked to see if they'd come back across the road to their breeding site. And over half of them, it deflected their movement. They didn't go back to the breeding site. So they did what's called a displacement experiment, where they displaced these guys and looked at their movements and what roads did with respect to their movements. And over half the time, it deflected their movement. So, you know, Semlich's stuff has shown that, yeah, you know, it's negatively impacting abundance around there, but it's also impacting movement as well. And these are forest roads. And again, for his type was unimportant. They had gravel and paved forest roads. And basically, whether it was gravel or paved, it reflected individuals at the same rate.
Did they do the dirt?
No, they didn't. They didn't have this type of road in there, I don't think. I think they just had... Well, yeah. Again, they were doing salamander stuff. But that's a good point. I actually have that down here about potential benefits of rutted up forest roads. Obviously, petroleum runoff and the chemicals, oils, things like that can have negative impacts, especially where they're in very close proximity to a wetland. And also acoustic interference. And this hasn't been published yet, but was presented at the last National Herpetological Meeting last year. Some folks out of University of Texas, I think, because the work was done right in Austin, and looking at acoustic interference of road traffic with breeding activity. And grad students that is working on it show that basically calling rate of males decreases when you get closer to the roads. And she had all these different, she's measuring the acoustic interference and the decibels and all this type of stuff. And showed this change in rate. As traffic decreased even, individual males out there would start calling more. Or if they displaced males that were not calling much and displaced them to wetlands without acoustic interference, they started calling at a higher rate. So this can also have these types of effects interfering with breeding activity. Certainly also an issue with the females detecting those breeding calls and hearing those breeding calls and being able to find the males. All right, so this is a possible benefit, quote unquote, that Matt suggested, is that when you get into some of these forest roads, if they're all rutted up like this, it's not uncommon to see anurans breeding in here, and especially toads. And toads can develop pretty quick in these things. I mean, they can go through metamorphosis in a couple weeks. So, but a concern of this is, what I call and what I called in the past for just things that attract things and kill them is an ecological trap. And that can work in two ways. A, you have tadpoles developing here, and if this is traveled quite frequently, those tadpoles could get crushed. And then secondly, this appears to be good breeding habitat, and again, they could breed in this habitat, and the duration, or the quote-unquote hydroperiod, although ruts don't technically have hydroperiods, the hydroperiod of the water there, the duration of the water, surface water is present, may not be sufficient enough to allow the tadpoles to go through metamorphosis, or it may heat up beyond some temperature level that results in mortality of those tadpoles or the embryos. So, I'm cautious to say that this is a good thing. Anyways. At the same time, I don't think anybody's looked at that. So, in fact, that book talks about this being a possible benefit. I think that's actually, I scanned that out of the book. It was passed around. Okay. All right, so mitigating road effects. Now this is primarily, it's historically been a conservation practice over in Europe, and I guess I should say especially in England, where they've documented really high mortality rates associated with roads for various amphibians. And so they started doing this stuff back in the 90s, and now we're starting, to recognize some of the negative impacts of roads, and you're starting to see some of these things going on.
Really, this is the company that is kind of at the forefront of providing quote-unquote amphibian tunnels underneath of roads and or barriers to amphibian movement so they don't get into the road. And that's their website. Now, the first thing that should be done is, first of all, if you're worried about this happening, is really document that, you know, there are individuals, that this is a significant effect. This is a very expensive, okay, to do these types of activities. And ideally, you would like to monitor and demonstrate that, yes, indeed, there are individuals that are dispersing in this direction. Maybe they're all dispersing out the other way, and it doesn't matter, okay, just because there's a natural corridor going the other direction. If you can place a road so it is away from natural corridors, that's something that folks Department of Transportation can do. So if ideally find out if they are, if you can also really quantify the mortality rate. And again, the way, you know, really kind of to do that is getting out here and counting the number of individuals being killed, and also figure out what's the natural mortality rate within the wetland itself. Figure out if it's significant or not. That's a lot of work, it's a lot of research, and you can't do that for every road that's out there. So if you see things being killed and it's a concern, maybe that's something to look into, and probably where you're going to see most of this activity around big wetlands and big highways that have high exposure to the public. And still in these cases, you don't see it very often in our country. So one thing you can do is you can create basically drift vent diversions, so just like we use for experiments, except this is much more rugged drift vents that can last over time. You can put drift vents in, and the kind that they establish is basically, you can kind of see it here, it has a lip, so it kind of prevents them from hopping over. And it's 16 inches in height, which stops pretty much most amphibians. They can't get quite up over it, so they'll just follow it around. And you can prevent them. That's one thing. You can just prevent them from coming across here. Okay, so you can just make them go a different direction. That's the first step, and it's not as expensive as if you try to create some conduit of movement underneath the road, which is another thing you can do. Another concern, especially in the herpetofauna world, is mortality by snakes. And I just, you know, this is an amphibian class, but I'll make note of that, is that snakes will get out, will be in the roads to A, warm, B, they move slow, C, especially things like rattlesnakes are, their immediate instinct is when they see, you know, a car approaching, is to coil up and to stop, you know, because they think it's a predator, and so they get run over, you know. So snake mortality is a big concern on roads. I just bring that up, and 16 inches is not high enough for a snake, they'll get over it. So there are designs for snakes too where this is higher. It's just taller drift vents. Okay, now if you do have an interest in actually getting them underneath the road, and why would you have an interest? Well, if you have one important breeding system here and you have another important breeding system over here, then you really should think about, again, maintaining that corridor. And so what we're talking about doing is running this out for however far, you know, maybe a couple hundred meters on both sides, and funneling these individuals into a couple tunnels that can allow interaction both ways from both populations. And they're just tunnels like this, and you know, this is what they look like. This is made, they call it a polymer concrete. I guess they're mixing concrete and plastics together, and they make it into a mold, and down these things they go. You know, this is obviously, you know, culverts are not, and underpasses are not novel to the wildlife field, especially with large terrestrial mammals like black bears and things like this, for major highways. But this is certainly on a smaller scale, smaller road, and Anyways, another thing that could be used. So. Now, the other thing you can do, and this is so simple, and you know we may think this is cheesy because you don't see this very often, is just putting up signs, making people aware so that they slow down and don't run over the damn things, all right? And so you can have salamander crossing signs, slow down, you know, and, you know, don't crush the toads, yield. And so these are used quite a bit in Europe and not very often over here, and I like these. You know, it's just makes people also aware, you know, that there are amphibians out there. And something for you to talk about, too, when you're talking to the public and they see things like this. And they can talk about how amphibians are declining and the importance of them and all this stuff. So those are the three main things. I just thought I would drop this in at the very end, which, again, is another thing you get in a forestry class. And when you're building forest roads, there are some things that you can probably do to make them more amphibian friendly. And in general, they follow the best management practices. And that is, first of all, to don't construct them on slopes any greater than 12% slopes, okay? You don't want a road on a cliff, right? And also to follow the contours. Instead of going perpendicular to the contours, follow the contours. That reduces erosion, etc. And locate them all at the upper contours, which we've talked about. Try to get them as far away as you can from the amphibian habitat, at least the breeding habitat. It still may reduce terrestrial habitat, as we talked about, for salamanders. Also might reduce, if they get rutted up, might reduce the ecological trap, my ecological trap hypothesis that needs to be tested. Okay, certainly minimize stream crossings, which is a basic forest management practice so that you, because it's expensive, really, to go across streams a bunch of times, but it also has negative, you know, ecological impacts. And this is one thing that they recommend, maybe one of the guys that have had forestry, or one of the folks that have forestry could explain, why do you want to maximize light exposure on your forest roads? You can grow stuff on them, and so you're thinking of it from a food plot standpoint. You can plant different. Yeah. Hold the soil, exactly. So you can get some type of crop on there, and that can hold the soil, like wheat and things like that. Also can provide wildlife habitat if you plant something that wildlife will eat. Not maybe necessarily amphibian habitat, but, you know, things like turkeys and grouse and quail or whatever, you know. Well, it's a forest road, probably not too many quail, but. And the other thing from a maintenance standpoint. Increase light, you increase solar radiation. What does that do? I don't know. Yeah, it dries out more quickly. Yeah, so when it rains, it dries out more quickly and your roads are maintained better. Okay, now I agree with all that, except one thing about this is that from the amphibian standpoint, it's not going to be good. You might be able to provide habitat for other animals, but the hotter and drier it is, the worse it is for an amphibian. I mean, there's no two ways about that. So that's not very beneficial, although it can have other benefits for other wildlife species. And again, you can maintain your roads if you plan to maintain that road. If you don't plan to maintain, as I mentioned before, you know, my recommendation is to replant the thing in, you know, some native species and try to reestablish that forest cover. All right. Any questions? So that pretty much concludes amphibian ecology and conservation.